So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Joining me as co-host is Jillian York. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is great.
So Rafat Ali, our normal co-host, is off on his honeymoon in India, just at the time when his startup is being kind of sold and resold again. So appropriately for him, he won't be around to comment on it. But Jillian, you are at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF. And tell us a little bit about what you do there and kind of your background. You were also at the Berkman Center at Harvard as well, right?
Yeah, so I joined EFF last May as the Director for International Freedom of Expression. And before that, I spent about 3 years at the Berkman Center, which was just fascinating insight into so many different aspects of this work on the internet. But I was really excited to move toward a more advocacy role. So at the EFF, my job is to essentially focus on free expression all over the world, everywhere but the U.S., which, you know, is a whole lot of work for a couple of people. But it's incredibly fulfilling work. And we do a whole lot of different things, from educating people on to online safety, to, you know, calling on foreign governments, calling them out for their behavior. And then also in terms of companies and what they're doing, we have been critical at times and excited at times by the work of some of our local Silicon Valley companies, Google and Twitter and Facebook and all of those. And so you'll see us giving a whole lot of different commentary on what they're up to.
Yeah, I mean, I think over the years we've really appreciated at Media Shift, and just I think in general the kind of technology world in Silicon Valley here has really appreciated what the EFF has kind of brought to the table, just kind of fighting for the rights of a lot of people, and freedom of expression has been a big thing with Media Shift. I mean, we've been covering this for a while, what's going on in Egypt and what's going on, I mean, what's basically now exploded into the Arab Spring. But, you know, for the longest time, the internet in so many of these countries and blogs, I mean, started with blogs and even forums, I'd say, and, you know, online postings and things. I mean, those were the only places you really could get information that you could trust in a lot of these countries where, you know, newspapers and other things were kind of censored or run by the state. You know, those, the bloggers, you know, starting in Iran, really were the one people that people actually trusted bloggers more than they trusted the other media in those places.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You've got kind of this situation where in a lot of less democratic states, as I would like to put it, you've got this sort of contrast between state media and the more traditional or alternative or independent media, which often has to operate under a certain degree of self-censorship that, you know, I'm sure very reluctantly, of course. And so bloggers and other netizens, as I would say, sort of provide this really interesting third way. They're not exempt from censorship, but they're often able to go places that the independent media can't, just by nature of their status in these countries.
Yeah. I'll be curious to get your thoughts on some of that. I mean, on this episode, we've got a lot going on, a lot around mergers. Mm. We've got, you know, the Center for Investigative Reporting is a nonprofit investigative group based in Berkeley, is trying to merge with the Bay Citizen, which is a local and regional nonprofit kind of watchdog journalism, local journalism startup. So we'll talk to the kind of the principals there. And then we'll also talk to, GigaOM has announced that they're going to be buying paid content from The Guardian, which is another merger that's very interesting to us as Media Twits. I mean, paid content, which was founded by Rafat Ali and was sold to The Guardian in 2008, is now being sold from The Guardian to GigaOM. So we'll try to figure out, you know, what's that about. We'll have Omalik will be on, and Stacey Kramer from Paid Content to talk about that. And then also we'll talk about Twitter and censorship.
Let's start by talking with the folks at the Center for Investigative Reporting and Bay Citizen about their plans to try to merge the two nonprofit organizations.
So Phil Bronstein's chairman of the board of the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's formerly editor of the San Francisco Chronicle and Examiner. During his career as a reporter, he led investigative reporting teams and covered conflicts around the world. He's on the advisory board of Litquake, San Francisco Literary Festival. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Thank you very much.
We also have Robert Rosenthal, who's been at the executive director of Center for Investigative Reporting for 4 years. In that time, the staff's grown from 7 to 37 people and now seen as one of the most innovative and successful nonprofit journalism organizations. Before he was at CIR, Rosenthal was managing editor and vice president of the San Francisco Chronicle and executive editor and VP at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Before joining the Inquirer, he worked at the Boston Globe and New York Times. Welcome to the show, Rosie.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And finally, we have Brian Kelly, who's interim CEO of the Bay Citizen. Prior to joining Bay Citizen, Brian Kelly co-founded Reputation Defender, now known as Reputation.com, the world's first comprehensive online reputation management and privacy company. He's had over 10 years building online companies in a wide variety of industries, including music, sports, finance, and education. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks very much.
So our first kind of question is, you know, there's been you're working on a merger of nonprofits, so taking the Center for Investigative Reporting and merging it with the Bay Citizen, a local nonprofit kind of watchdog that started a few years ago. Center for Investigative Reporting has been around since 1977. I guess I'll throw this first to you, Rosie. Why is there a need, I guess, for CIR to get involved with what's going on with Bay Citizen?
Well, from a journalistic point of view, it really matches with all our strategies. You know, we already do a lot of reporting and investigative reporting in California under the label of California Watch. And many of our stories are already relevant to the Bay Area. In fact, most of them are published in newspapers in the Bay Area or on public radio and television, on websites. So there's a natural match. And what we also do is take a local story and sometimes turn it into a national story through a national partner like NPR or Frontline or the NewsHour. Right now we're doing a documentary for Al Jazeera English related to nuclear safety that grew out of a California story we did about Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant after Fukushima last year. So there's a natural match, and for us it means that you can take a macro story on anything and bring it down to a local level, or take a hyper-local story and turn it into not only a story that's relevant in the Bay Area, but also relevant to a much larger audience. And I'll give you one example. Imagine a team of people who are focused on accountability journalism and the way we would cover technology and all the issues around technology. It's a very local story for the Bay Area. And it's also a story of national and global interest. And on one other point, I just want to say we're really hoping, if this does happen, that we can create a really engaged audience in the Bay Area that helps inform our content, helps us find solutions, and really builds up an affinity not only for the stories and information we're creating around the Bay Area, but also on a global scale. So for us, it means it's a natural extension of our strategy. And it's something that we think is a huge opportunity to take our storytelling to every level.
Now, Phil, people have kind of said that you were kind of the driving force behind this idea, that someone at Bay Citizen had approached you and you kind of thought the only way you really wanted to get involved with Bay Citizen is through this kind of merger. Is that true?
Well, not quite the way you stated, Mark. I mean, I would be happy to be involved with the Bay Citizen on a variety of levels. Like many people in San Francisco, I knew Warren Hellman, benefited from his counsel and his friendship, and thought that he was a spectacular philanthropist who cared a lot about local community. Witnessed his Bluegrass Festival every year, free in the park, that costs probably millions of dollars. What I really felt was that we had these two organizations, both nonprofits. Rosie's spoken eloquently, and Brian can speak eloquently, and has spoken eloquently to the, you know, we hate to use the word, but the synergies, the complementary aspects, and how they fit together well. And it just seemed to me that that was the logical way to go. I think that consolidation and the creation of a larger force of people, both on the technology side and on the journalism side, and how they work together is going to be a tremendous boon to the Bay Area. You mentioned yourself that the Bay Citizen has a watchdog role. We take that very seriously. That is also the mission of CIR. And I think when Rosie spoke about the engagement aspects, I think a lot of that, whether it's a membership strategy or simply just engaging the audiences more in the journalism and having a back and forth relationship, that's something that is, I think, easier to start on a local level and then expand out.
And Brian, I guess give us your take, coming from the Bay Citizen. I've seen a lot of the commentary that's happened on your site, where a lot of people who've given money to the Bay Citizen are worried, you know, what's going to happen next. You know, is the Bay Citizen kind of going to lose its voice to some extent? Will CIR, you know, take over in some way? Is this some kind of grand scheme to bring the Chronicle into it somehow? I've just seen a lot of kind of funny comments on Bay Citizen site. What's your response to the people there?
So my response actually echoes Phil's and Rosie's to a great extent. There really are a lot of synergies between our organizations, especially on our depth of reporting. The Bay Citizen was initially founded to fill the void of coverage on very important local issues of civic politics, education, environment that weren't being reported in this area. And we've done that really successfully in the 2 years that we've been in operation. And I think the chance to join forces with CIR really gives us increased reach, increased depth of coverage that CIR is extremely well known for, and just gives us an opportunity to further that mission, to go that much deeper, to increase that coverage and our audience beyond just what we have here. And, you know, that's really our biggest strength right now is we've just built a great audience and our coverage is really strong. So I'm just excited that CIR can help us increase that and the connection with our audience.
Why did you lose so many top people at Bay Citizen? Why did they all leave?
Well, they all left for very various reasons. It was definitely an impact when Weber left on the early side from the organization, and he obviously left to join another organization and an opportunity that he wanted to pursue. And Lisa Frazier, our former CEO, left for very personal reasons, and of course Warren Hellman unfortunately passed away. So it was certainly striking the timing of all of these. But and I speak truthfully to this, they are each independently not connected.
Do you think that the Bay Citizen has struggled in some ways as far as kind of creating an identity within the Bay Area? I mean, I'm in San Francisco, and if I talk to, you know, three random people, I doubt that they would know about the Bay Citizen.
Well, I can I actually can counter that. We've done a very good job on the ground marketing for what we do. In fact, we had a street team that was out there educating people about the Bay Citizen, and one in four of those people ended up donating to the Bay Citizen because they really liked our mission, liked our product, and so many of them already knew about the Bay Citizen and were eager to support us. I think we're undercredited with the amount of people that know who the Bay Citizen is.
Hey, Mark, I'd also like to add that, you know, one of the things that the Bay Citizen has developed, and this was part of their model initially, was what we'll call an audience-facing approach, which is they are a membership audience news organization. CIR is read, the work that's done by CIR is read, watched, and listened to by millions of people. But it is more a little bit of a wholesale news and journalism organization in that it distributes, CIR distributes its content to a wide variety of media partners. And so in that way, its content gets disseminated. What we'd like to do is kind of plug those two together so that, you know, we have, again, an audience-facing approach and strategy, but with the combined firepower, reporting and journalism firepower of these two organizations.
Jillian, I'm curious, you know, you're in San Francisco. What's your take on Bay Citizen? Have you used it a lot?
Sure. Well, so I've actually only been in San Francisco since May of last year, and so I'm still getting to know the landscape. And it's interesting to watch it be such a rapidly changing landscape. I'm really only vaguely familiar with the Bay Citizen. I've read it a few times, but I think if I might jump in and ask a question here, I do recall Bay Citizen having previously worked with the Berkeley Journalism School, and I'm curious to know if there's any room for future partnerships with either Berkeley or other J schools in the area.
Yes, I mean, the broad answer is yes. I think that we can actually have expanded relationships, and Rosie should address this a little bit more, because you know CIR has been involved in these relationships as Bay Citizen, but I think we want to expand our relationships. We certainly don't want to contract them.
So what are you guys working on now as far as getting this thing hammered out? What are the kind of the last details that need to be worked out?
Well, right now we're on the first details. We haven't gotten to the last details yet. That's going to be a great moment for all of us, I think. You know, we're just getting groups of people from both organizations together. I think that's pretty critical. Get to know each other, talk about what strategy might be going forward. And that, you know, that's really coming from the sort of grassroots reporting level and staff level up. So I think we are open to all sorts of ideas. We have a list of sort of what would be naturally complementary activity that we will try and start on day one. But we have a period of time to kind of put a plan together, and a plan that that needs to be voted on by both boards, both the CIR board and the Bay Citizen board.
Yeah, I just want to add one thought to that. That you know, hopefully, when this is all resolved, and this isn't not going to be about having a CIR way of doing things or a Bay Citizen way of doing things. It's really about evolving into a much more effective, powerful organization with a lot of its focus on accountability journalism, not only in the Bay Area, but you know, to a much broader audience. So it's a really exciting opportunity. It's not without challenges, but as Phil said, I want to reiterate, this is really, a lot of this is going to be driven by staff input and really opening up creative thinking.
What about the sustainability part of it? I mean, that's something that I think Bay Citizen has been really good at, kind of raising some money initially. Is there, in your talks, in your thoughts about how you're going to combine the different organizations, do you talk about kind of the financial part of it and how that's going to work?
Well, that was the other buzzword that I thank you for reminding me, was sustainability.
Don't forget about that.
We don't forget about it. We talk about it every day. It's part of the ongoing conversation. It's a fact of life that you can have the greatest ambitions in the world and the best ideas, and if you can't support them financially, it's not going to do you much good. But, you know, both Bay Citizen and CIR have their respective strengths when it comes to fundraising. CIR has been fabulous at engaging with foundations. Bay Citizen obviously has got a very deep personal donor base. We're looking at things like membership and events and other ways to generate revenue. You mentioned Texas Tribune. We have a close relationship with Evan Smith, who runs Texas Tribune. They're doing quite well in these areas, some corporate sponsorships. So we're looking at all those things. But I do think that immediately there's a natural joining of the sort of personal donor base that Bay Citizen has done such a fabulous job of putting together, and then the foundation, the reputation of foundation work that CIR has done so well. So I think those two will go together, and we hope, you know, 1 + 1 = 3.
I just want to add one quick thought on that, because obviously it's a crucial question. But one of the things we've done at CIR as it's grown is really not only think about high-quality, unique journalism and what it means, but also how do we all think of ourselves as entrepreneurs? How do we think of ourselves as people who can help sustain the organization? And, you know, one form of that might be just by doing really important stories that people are going to fund or support in terms of the quality of the work. It's also thinking of really innovative ways of storytelling on every platform, and also creating products, apps out of the content. How do we use data in terms of how do you customize it? Are there different potential places where the data can be used and sold, actually? So I think you're really looking at an organization that can merge and really also create a whole new approach to how they think about sustainability, not only from the top people who are traditionally in the business side, but really from the bottom up as well.
Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Om Malik's an award-winning journalist who's worked for Quick Nikkei News, Forbes.com, Red Herring, and Business 2.0 before founding Giga Omni Media, the company that publishes a group of blogs including Giga Om, New TV, Earth to Tech, and Web Worker Daily. Om also has a personal blog where he blogs about music, books, and life. Welcome to the show, Om.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And Stacey Kramer is editor and EVP of Content Next Media, whose main properties are paidcontent.org, Paid Content UK, Content Sutra, and MocoNews.net. She joined the company in 2004 as executive editor of Paid Content and later served as executive editor of Content Next Media. She's been writing about the intersection of tech and media, entertainment and sports since the days before the web, the old and golden days. She's also been co-host of Media Twits before. Yeah, did you want to talk about what The Guardian's role is going to be in all this?
Well, you know, there is a lot of stuff we are not talking about because of the terms of the deal, except that, you know, they are going to be pretty hands-off. That much I can tell you.
Oh, okay. You're not talking about the terms of the deal and what, you know, how that works, but there is some stock that's changing hands, and The Guardian will become a shareholder in your company, right?
Yes, they will. And but it's a minority position.
Okay. And so was it can you say that was there cash involved or was it an all stock deal?
I cannot. Like, I mean, that's exactly what it means when I said, you know, we can't talk about the deal terms. So I mean, whatever we had was like disclosed in the press release yesterday.
So tell us about your plans with Paid Content. I mean, what is it? I had posted something about this on social networks and someone said, well, what, you know, their question was, what can you do that The Guardian couldn't do?
We have a lot of people at Paid Content Group who are, you know, actually doing a lot of stuff we do at GigaOM. So when you have people combined together, you can actually focus on, you know, a much broader set of topics from a content perspective and from the pure technology perspective. So I think that is number one. Number one is that the two editorial teams are additive to each other. They're not like, you know, they don't take away from each other. So when we start to deploy our collective teams, we will be able to cover a much broader swath of topics. And that is number one. Number two is, we do know the online businesses a little better than, you know, some of the more, you know, bigger companies, because this is the only thing we do, right? We don't publish a newspaper. We don't have a television channel. We don't have other, you know, research, you know, databases or anything. What we have is our online product, our research, and our events, and we take... And we have developed a whole system around it.
And when you talk about synergies, do you think there's a chance that there could be layoffs involved?
Well, you know, we don't know any of those things. But like clearly, as I wrote in my blog post yesterday, we bought this asset for people. So to think about layoffs is probably the farthest from my mind right now. Not even goes through my head. It's like, no, this is all about the people. And like, people were the defining reason we acquired, you know, Content Next assets.
But you don't think that you have any overlapping coverage areas?
Well, these, you know, we are journalists, man. We're supposed to adapt. We write about technology. We'll try and make sure that everybody's happy knowing what they are. That's what makes great bloggers and reporters, is people writing about things that make them excited. So we just need to just find that. And I think that has always been the principle of GigaOM, and now by extension, Paid Content, that we will find, you know, people to, you know, to cover beats and, you know, things they get super jazzed about.
Yeah, and Mark, just to add on to that, I mean, You know, I've written a lot over the years about when people use the word synergies. And usually, you know, in a lot of cases, particularly in larger companies, but it often happens that synergy is equals here's where we can cut costs and save money when we come together. And this isn't about that. This is about synergy in the purest sense of the word, the real sense of the word. What do we bring together that makes what we all do better? And one of the things is that, you know, GigaOM and Paid Content and Content Next Media each had some of the same ideas about how to progress. Some of the things that we wanted to do, they've been able to really succeed at, like a research division with GigaOM Pro. And, you know, that was something that we very much wanted and we thought was always going to be important. News research events. And that's what GigaOM has right now is news research events. And it's a way for us to expand our structure within a company that's already figured out how to do some of those things and for them to take the best of what we do into their structure.
There's been so many kind of, you know, ReadWriteWeb got bought, TechCrunch got bought, GigaOM is kind of getting bigger. Why is this such a big time of consolidation?
Some companies being around long enough to get to that stage where they can decide whether they should be on their own or they should be going, they can do more when they're with another company, when they band together. And it comes with people also recognizing the value of what we've been doing all along. Not We Paid Content, but We GigaOM, We Paid Content, We, all of these sites, all of these new media companies that are no longer new media, we're media. We're going to be a constantly evolving media, not a media that separates between new and old.
But why can't they survive on their own? I mean, why if they've been so successful, why have they all kind of been bought out and, you know, kind of combined? And why is that all happening? If I mean, they all seem like success stories. Why is it a success to kind of combine and be bought out?
I mean, why is it not a success story, you know, to be combined? Like, I think when you combine a lot of forces, you get scale. And you get, you know, I'm not saying, you know, everybody should just keep combining their sites without thinking through things. But like our deal with Paid Content is essentially like really thought through combination of two sites coming together and making, you know, making 2 + 2 = 4, not just, you know, being dilutive. I think that's what it really is, that as the marketplace becomes more mature, we have to adapt to the changing marketplace. And I think this is what makes us as a company different, is that whenever we see an emergent opportunity, not just like from a, it's not about advertising, it's about emergent opportunity in how the society and the industry are changing, we jump on that. Just like we jumped on, you know, JK on the Run and acquired that to go all mobile gadgets when mobile gadgets were about to take off. We went the same way with the Apple blog. Like, both those deals happened in 2008, and Apple stock since then has grown so much that kind of tells you that we were on the right side of the history. And I believe that we will continue to do similar, you know, deals in order to bring in expertise into the company to actually expand the footprint of what we do. And the reason we are doing this is essentially we have one customer, which is our reader. We want to make sure they get the best we can provide for them.
So one question I had for you, Om, is, you know, when we talked about this a while ago, when Michael Arrington was going through a lot of his trouble with, you know, this, with the crunch fund, and, you know, he wanted to be part of the deal flow, and he took so much flack for that. I think Rafat brought up the point, well, what about Om? You know, he's a VC, he's running a publishing concern, he's got the exact same situation that Arrington, and no one ever brings that up for you. Why is that?
Well, I think, you know, we talked about this before, and it's the same thing right now. Look, you know, I'm not in charge of the editorial newsroom. I'm not. Like, you know, Ernie Sanders and Nicole and Stacey, they're the people who are going to be controlling the editorial process. I'm just another writer for the site. And every time I do write for the site, there is a massive disclosure every single time. And on top of that, I don't write about anything even tangentially related to True, with the exception of WordPress, because WordPress is something I'd been writing about long before you know, Drew came into the picture.
I'm just kind of curious personally, you know, what it's like for you, because we talked about this a little bit before you came on, that, you know, when you go back and rewind in time, you know, you're this reporter for a tech, you know, publication like Business 2.0, and a lot of us were in that position, and now you're this kind of media mogul. I mean, is it something you always wanted to do, something you kind of, were you an accidental entrepreneur? How did it happen?
Well, I don't like to think of myself as a media mogul by any means. You know, I started this company with the idea that the industry was being disrupted, and, you know, if not me, then somebody else would do it. I think Rafat and Arrington both had done successfully the early version of what I did, and it was very clear that it was time for me to do it. You know, ever since then, it's been, you know, we've been on a journey, right? Like, so bringing in Paul as the CEO, you know, helped us become, you know, go from being a blog to a company and a business which is focused on running things properly. You know, bringing in people like Nicole Solis helped us go, you know, from like just a random aggregation of reporters and bloggers to a proper newsroom. And then everything has been, you know, very, you know, one step at a time. But the idea was from day one that there would be a new kind of a media entity required to cover the fast-changing world of technology. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to avoid the, I guess, in many ways, the mistakes of, you know, of Forbes.com and Red Herring and Business 2.0 and try and do things a little differently. I guess that's what it really is. And, you know, talking about being an entrepreneur, I think being an immigrant is in itself an act of entrepreneurship, right? Because you come here, you really are a startup with no startup capital. You just come here and you have to, you know, you have to just grow. And I think that is what is how I think about everything, whether it's being an immigrant, starting a company, writing a book, in relationships. I just know how to start from ground zero and, you know, going forward one step at a time without looking back. And I think that's what, you know, we do at GigaOM every single day.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks.
Cool. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Twitter is, you know, one of the companies in Silicon Valley that that is, you know, has become, I mean, really a phenomenon and a new way of communicating. And in so many places, people really depend on Twitter to get information out, to organize, to just, you know, basically have some mode of free speech. It's blocked in some countries, and in other countries it isn't. And now Twitter has come out and said that, you know, they will try to comply. They've come out with this kind of very interesting regime of saying we're going to try to comply with what the country's rules are, but they're also saying we're going to show when something is censored, and we're also going to use the chilling effects site to basically be very transparent about what we're doing. So, you know, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the Twitter and what they're doing. You know, I've seen kind of different points of view on this, that, you know, what they're doing is horrible. There was this huge backlash on Twitter. People want to have a Twitter blackout where they're basically kind of boycotting Twitter for a day. And then there's other people who said, you know, wait a second, you know, maybe what Twitter is doing is actually pretty thoughtful and actually a little bit more subtle, and maybe they're actually doing something that's a little bit better than others have done. I mean, what do you think? What's your thinking? Has it changed on this?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, I kind of come down somewhere in the middle. I mean, EFF, you know, recognizes that companies need to abide by the law in the countries in which they're operating. And so that, you know, that, of course, applies to the U.S., even though we may be at times fighting those laws. And it, of course, applies to other countries as well. And so, you know, when it comes to Twitter, they've called themselves the free speech wing of the free speech party. They've been generally great on free expression. And so we were actually quite surprised by the reaction to this decision. Now, of course, you know, I think our perspective, you know, knowing the people at Twitter and knowing their track record, our perspective has been that we, you know, we're hesitant, but we kind of trust that they're not going to be implementing this policy unless they have to. And so I guess the overview of their policy is basically just that they will take down content at the request of foreign governments, with a, I think they've said, legitimate legal request that they will do analysis on. And then they will be transparent about that takedown. They will both post that this tweet has been deleted for people in that country. And then they will also submit their transparency reports to Chilling Effects. And so we see this as sort of the best case scenario in an unfortunate situation.
Yeah, because, you know, Google has kind of gone through this with China and said, you know, we're not going to have anything in China. And then they've kind of gone back and said, well, we'll link to another search engine in Hong Kong. And it just seems like it's a real difficult thing for these technology companies to figure out how to kind of navigate so many different rules in all these different countries.
It is. I mean, you know, I think ultimately the laws in these countries are the problem, not the companies. But, you know, there are, of course, questions about whether or not companies should be entering certain countries in the first place. There was news earlier this week that Google, at the behest of a court order in India, was forced to take down content. I believe Facebook was also forced to take down content. And so, you know, in that case, you know, the question is, okay, should these companies be operating in India where free expression is not exactly in the government's high priority at the moment? You know, now Twitter, I doubt at this point that they would consider entering India given the circumstances, but Google and Facebook are already there. And so the question becomes, what do they do? If they resist, they put their employees on the ground at risk. And so their options are either complying or pulling out of the country entirely.
Yeah, and it's hard to believe that these companies would pull out of India. I mean, India is such a massive market that they'd be losing out so much if they pulled out completely.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if they did, I mean, would that be, if Google were to pull out of India, would that be better for the Indian people? I'm not so sure about that. I mean, India does have its own innovation. But I suspect that, you know, if all of these American companies were to pull out of India, you know, India is not going to go, say, as far as the Chinese government in kind of creating a country intranet. But if we started to see Indian companies replacing American companies in that space, I guarantee that they would be more willing, or at least more susceptible to pressure to censor in the first place, even proactively.
Right. So at being as an American, kind of an outsider company, maybe that gives them a little bit of, you know, a reason to kind of fight them a little bit. Maybe they can get away with a little bit more, you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think that they, it seems to be that way. It's been that way a bit with Google. And I've seen some comparisons of Google's search engine in China with Chinese search engines. And you can certainly get access to more information than you can from the Chinese ones. And so it does seem that they can get away with a little bit more. Although still, you know, they are censoring pretty heavily in some of these cases. I would say that I don't believe that these companies should be entering China. But when it comes to countries like India or Brazil, where Twitter is under threat of being sued at the moment, you know, I think that's when it becomes a little bit of a trickier situation.
Yeah. And I mean, what is it about Twitter? Like, why is this? I mean, Twitter's been around for a while. Is it kind of just because of what's gone on with the Arab Spring that so many more people are using it in new ways, and there's just so much more organizing going on, and the governments are being more aware of it? I mean, is there something about this moment in particular why all of a sudden Twitter is becoming kind of the center of controversy around censorship?
Well, I think that for Twitter, I mean, I think that their decision to do this was probably made a long time ago. But in terms of the controversy, I think we're actually seeing sort of a global awakening towards digital rights issues, which is fascinating. I mean, some of the activism that we saw, not just in the United States around SOPA and PIPA, the two copyright-related bills, but globally. I mean, I was in Egypt on the blackout day, the day that Wikipedia went black and Google had a special Google Doodle about the bills. And everyone in Egypt, in Cairo, was asking me about SOPA and PIPA, not about the situation in Egypt. And so it's, you know, it's really a global issue at this point. And so, you know, when it comes to the idea of doing a blackout day for Twitter, I mean, personally, it's not something that I'm going to be behind, but I understand why people are doing it. And I really do support the idea behind it, the idea of bringing this to people's attention and making them aware of these jurisdictional issues.
Thanks for tuning in to the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank our co-host, Jillian York, as well as our guests, Phil Bronstein, Robert Rosenthal, Brian Kelly, Om Malik, and Stacey Kramer. We also want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to check out all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift. And our sister...